Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Coming up at 9:30 this morning, we'll hear from Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. Then in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking baseball with author Thomas Christopher Green. And we're going to get ready for Halloween by heading to Cuttingsville, where we'll learn about the history of the Bowman family mansion and mausoleum, maybe even find out if it's haunted or not. But we start today discussing the Build Back Better Act that's being debated in Washington and is supported by all three members of the Vermont Congressional Delegation. Last week, a coalition of Vermont nonprofits rallied in support of the bill. We're going to speak with a couple of them. With me this morning is Anor Horton, Executive Director of Hunger Free Vermont. Anor, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
Good morning. Great to have you. We also have Ruby Baker, Executive Director of Community of Vermont Elders, or COVE. Ruby, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure.
Sure. Listeners, if you've got a question about the Build Back Better Act for our guests, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Anor, let's start out. Tell us about the work that Hunger Free Vermont does.
Yeah, well, Hunger Free Vermont is Vermont's statewide anti-hunger advocacy and education and technical assistance and training nonprofit. Our mission is to end the injustice of hunger and malnutrition for all Vermonters. So we work on all kinds of policy efforts to improve people's access to healthy food here in Vermont. We help schools start and expand their meal programs for kids, and we help child care centers do that too. We also work on legislation at the state level, and as you were saying in your intro, we also work at the federal level to support changes that are going to make programs like Three Squares Vermont and WIC and Meals on Wheels and the child nutrition programs that are federal programs, but they're run through our state. We want to make those work better for people here in Vermont.
And Ruby, what is the Community of Vermont Elders, or COVE?
COVE is a nonprofit here in Vermont that has been serving older Vermonters for 40 years as of this year. And really, our mission is to promote and protect the quality of life for all Vermonters as we age along the age spectrum. So not just retirees necessarily. And primarily, our work happens through two avenues, really working on legislation at the state level, and also working very closely with older Vermonters and the services that support them to make sure that they are safe and aging in a way that is of their own choosing, and that they are receiving what they need in order to age as well as possible.
And, Anor, you touched on some of the things that you're involved with on the federal level, things that, Hunger Free Vermont is concerned about. But what parts of Build Back Better would address food insecurity here in Vermont?
Yeah, that's a great question. We haven't heard too much about the food pieces of the Build Back Better Act, mm-hmm. and they all focus around nutrition for kids. And the two most important ones of those are, first of all, the Build Back Better Act would make many, many more schools in Vermont and around the country able to provide universal meals. That means breakfast and lunch at no charge for all of the students in the school, regardless of their family's income. And that's what we have happening right now all across the country because of the pandemic, but it's temporary right now. And the Build Back Better Act would provide a pathway for many schools to be able to provide universal school meals permanently. And it also has an option that would allow a state like Vermont to choose to bundle all the schools together and provide universal school meals for all the schools. And that's an effort we've been pushing, Hunger Free Vermont has been pushing here at the state level for quite a few years now. And the other really, really exciting child nutrition provision of the Build Back Better Act for Vermont and other really rural states like ours is what's called Summer EBT, an electronic benefits transfer. It would be a stipend that families with kids who receive free or reduced price school meals during the school year or who are in a school providing universal school meals would receive. They would receive a stipend on a card that's kind of like a debit card for the summer months to help them cover the increased food costs when their kids are home and not in school getting breakfast and lunch at school every day. And that's so important because summer is the hungriest time of the year for kids and for families with kids here in our state.
Ruby, what elements of the act are of interest to Cove?
I guess while there are certainly specific elements of the act, and I'm thinking about Medicare expansion and paid leave really most specifically for older Vermonters, I would say that the way we think about social services is really silos us by age. And so we think, these are the programs for kids. These are the programs for older adults. And I really want to push people to be thinking about age as a full spectrum. You know, many older adults are caring for children. All of us are aging and progressing towards that. So I would say that the whole bill is very interesting to Cove because it supports humans in this state and in this country. But specifically thinking about paid leave and Medicare will have the fastest and most direct impact on older adults here in Vermont, thinking about, you know, people who are caring for a spouse or a parent or a child or a kinship child who has joined their family through the paid leave. And then also thinking about Medicare, our eyes, ears, teeth. They are, you know, essential parts of the human body, and the fact that we fail to cover services for our bodies from the neck up essentially is appalling. So that's really where we're primarily focused, but we really support the whole bill.
Now, Ruby, last week was the Reconciliation Rally. What was that and who attended?
Oh gosh, there were representatives at the rally from really all across the spectrum. So groups talking about paid leave, different groups, and actually parents coming to talk about the impact of childcare expansion. Of course, Hunger Free Vermont was there. Let's Grow Kids was there. Cove was representing older adults and speaking to the Medicare expansion. And the rally was really to show our support and thank our legislators for their hard work in Washington and to make sure that everybody understands that we need the whole bill. We need all of these pieces. We need them now. They're going to impact everybody in the state of Vermont, whether directly or indirectly. And honestly, we can't afford not to pass the bill. The impact downstream is so huge and will save money in the long run. And I think we forget to think about sort of the long-term savings, both in terms of money, but also in terms of human suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's really important.
Nora, with the Senate so evenly split and with Senators Manchin and Sinema not going along with the rest of the Democrats, do you see any way the bill will be passed?
Yes, I do. I think that there is still a lot of negotiation that's happening. I think that, we get the politicians that we demand. fundamentally, our system of government requires us to really make our voices heard and put pressure on our legislators. And that's happening all around the country. And I think that pressure is actually working. I know that the news stories are just talking about cuts, and there will be some, I'm sure. But we have to keep on putting the pressure on Congress to honor their responsibility to pass legislation that's in the interest of all of us, their constituents. And I really appreciate what Ruby said. People, families are suffering in this country and have been for a really long time. And the provisions of this bill and the time frame of it. So most of the programs in the bill are set to, kind of have an 8-year, 9-year span of time to operate. And that is going to finally let us see, instead of these 1-year, 1-year emergency provisions that we've been seeing during the pandemic, it's going to let us actually find out how much we're going to save in healthcare, in education, in lost wages from work, in people not being able to participate in the consumer economy and not buy things that our companies make because they can't afford it, because all their money is going to childcare or all their money is going to taking care of a family member. People not participating in the workforce when we have such a labor shortage because it's cheaper to stay home than to pay for childcare or than to have someone help out with caring for an ill relative. You know, those are massive costs that we are incurring every day right now. And this bill is actually going to alleviate those costs. I think we're going to see incredible savings. And whether we do or not, it's the right thing to do for all of us. It's going to benefit everyone in this country, and it's going to massively benefit us here in Vermont.
And let's go to Fred, who's joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's a little dreary to morning, but
it is.
Who knows? I'll get better during the day. Okay, so anyways, the Build Back Better program is very interesting because the billions or trillions of dollars that are going to go into the economy, I'm trying to figure out what it's going to do. Right now, there's so much money now floating around in the economy that prices are going up. When you have a lot of money, prices go up. And then if you look at what's happening to interest rates are running around 3 to 4 basis points. Now, who wants to put their money in the bank when you're only going to get 3 or 4 basis points? Nobody. So they're going to put it in the stock market. So all this money is going to be put into the economy is probably going to end up in the stock market. Now, as far as inflation goes, they want to build back better. What do they want to build back? That's the big question.
All right, Fred, let me get an answer from our guest. You're asking a bit of a macroeconomic question, but Anur, I think maybe you can address, what it is that you'd like to see built back better.
Yes, and so, Fred, I think you're asking some really good questions, and I'm definitely not an economist, but I think it's important to think about how unequally and inequitably this money that you're talking about that's running around in our economy is distributed. And if you look at the future and the importance of maintaining our families, having the kids of today grow up to be the workers of tomorrow. If you think about where we actually are investing versus where we need to invest, I think that's where the Build Back Better Act starts to address the real inequities of our economic system and who's thriving right now and who is really struggling. So in the Build Back Better Act, there's provisions to help ensure that no family is paying more than 7% of their income for childcare, for example. There's provisions to help states build and rehab housing to produce more affordable housing. One of the big problems that employers in Vermont are talking about right now is that they can't hire people to work in Vermont, not because people don't want to work in Vermont, not because people don't want to come to Vermont, but because people can't find housing in Vermont and can't find housing they can afford that would allow them to take these jobs. So these are some of the, just some of the pieces of the Build Back Better Act that actually address fundamental problems in our economy today. And if they aren't, if something isn't done about them, they're going to persist. There's nothing in our economic system that's going to naturally balance these things out. I think we've seen that as inequality has risen and risen and risen over time. And the same groups of people, the same, marginalized and most vulnerable groups of people continue to have that experience over and over and over again in our economy and our society.
Ruby, the $3.5 trillion package could be pared down considerably. How concerned are you that items that you think are vital will be left out or reduced?
Yeah, I mean, we're really looking at the cuts to Medicare or the, not the cuts to Medicare, but the failure to expand Medicare, which is being discussed right now. And I just think that it's so incredibly short-sighted when we really think about, who Medicare covers, right? Because we are all aging, and if we're lucky, we get to become 65 or older and receive Medicare services. So ultimately the goal is to grow old, right? You don't want to die young. So you want to grow old. And if you fail to provide for older adults, you are essentially neglecting your own future self. So I think it's very short-sighted of us to think about not expanding Medicare coverage, especially if we look at all of the data and specifically to Vermonters. Vermont has a very high rate of dementia. Falls are the leading cause of unintentional injury deaths in Vermont. We have the fourth highest rate of death by suicide for people over the age of 65. All of these things are addressed when we start dealing with hearing aids. Getting people access to hearing aids actually reduces every single one of those. Vision care reduces every single one of those. Good dental care improves overall health. I think it's very short-sighted and puts us all at risk of terrible consequences if we don't care for our own bodies as we grow older, which we are all trying to do. So I think it's very short-sighted not to expand Medicare, and I hope that it doesn't get cut out of the bill, honestly.
Anor, how do the child care, paid leave, health care provisions in the bill impact childhood hunger, if not directly, then indirectly?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Hunger Free Vermont, our mission is to end hunger. But the thing about hunger is that you can't end hunger by only working on hunger. Because if you think about, just think about your own budget for a minute, your own monthly budget for your household expenses, your critical basic needs. There's not a lot in that basic critical needs budget that you can negotiate. You can't negotiate your rent or your mortgage payment, can't negotiate your electric bill or your gas bill or your bill for wood, whatever you heat your house with. But you can choose to buy less healthy, less expensive food, or buy less food. Food is the flexible piece of all of our basic needs budget. And so so I often say that hunger in a family, in a community, is kind of the canary in the coal mine. It's showing us that people just do not have enough money to cover their basic needs. And the way that they're dealing with that is they're actually reducing the amount of healthy food that they're eating and that their kids are eating. And not only is that a horrible form of human suffering and stress that as a society we should seek to end, but it leads to all kinds of very problematic consequences. So it increases healthcare needs for that family and those kids. It reduces children's ability to focus and succeed in school. It increases behavioral problems for kids and adults. It increases mental health issues. So all of those, all of these consequences, they can't be separated out from one another. So if people can afford their housing, they can buy better food. If people can afford childcare, they are able to better meet their nutritional needs. So everything is interconnected, and that is why when you start talking about, well, a piece of, let's take this piece of the bill out, let's take that piece of the bill out, the whole opportunity for us to transform the way that we operate as a society, for us to make sure that all of us can meet our basic needs, that's what falls apart when we start taking pieces out. And that's why Ruby and I are here representing a whole coalition that also includes Voices for Vermont's Children and the Vermont Food Bank and many others, as Ruby mentioned earlier. We're all here together saying you can't start picking and choosing. This is a vision of what's required to help people meet their basic needs and have fundamental human rights and start putting some fundamental equity back in our society. And we want the whole bill. We want it to pass, and we want it now. And that's our message to everybody in Congress and Washington, D.C. right now.
Anur Horton is the executive director of Hunger Free Vermont. Ruby Baker is executive director of Community of Vermont Elders, or COVE. Thank you both for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks so much, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be back to hear Zeb Norris of Classic Hits Vermont, WCVT 101.7, talking with the Monkees, Mickey Dolenz. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and tomorrow night at the Flynn, the Monkees will be playing. So I'm going to turn things over to Zeb Norris of Classic Hits Vermont WCVT 101.7. He had the opportunity to talk to the Monkees' Mickey Dolenz. Let's listen to his interview.
101.7 WCVT Classic Hits Vermont with the theme from the Monkees. And on the telephone, I have Mickey Dolenz this morning. Good morning, Mickey, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your interest.
Let's get started, shall we? Is it true that you're too busy singing to put anybody down?
Yeah, I guess so. That was sort of the theme of the show. It was a television show about an imaginary group that wanted to be the Beatles, like every other kid around the world. And so it spoke to all those kids out there in their basements and garages and living rooms.
And my understanding is that the show was inspired partly by the Beatles movies Help and A Hard Day's Night, which both had such a great good time feeling themselves, those movies.
That's true, but the actual creators of the show, Bob Rafelson especially, had actually created a show before those Beatle movies.
Really?
About a band. It was a folk group, if I'm not mistaken. And it was about their adventures, because unlike Hard Day's Night and Help, which are, of course, incredible, great movies, the Monkees television show, we were never successful. It was the struggle for success.
Right, which is really weird, because then you guys actually became a band and were instantly hyper-successful, so you had this kind of dichotomy going on.
I know. That's the bizarre kind of interesting story. Mike Nesmith used to say that it was like Pinocchio becoming a real little boy, but I think that's what the producers must have had that in mind, that we were actually going to go on the road and play and sing, because you had to be able to play an instrument and mm-hmm. sing, and
right.
Besides the acting, and you had to be able to do all of that in the auditions.
Well, we'll get to all of this in just a second, because it gets so confusing, but let's talk about the audition. You've probably told this story a million times, but you had already been in show business before the Monkees audition came about. And how did you hear about it? What happened at the audition? Just fill me in. Tell the story.
Sure. Yes, I had a series when I was 10 years old on NBC called Circus Boy. And it was almost exactly 10 years later that my agent called and said, there's an audition for a series at Screen Gems, same studio that I did Circus Boy at. I had been up for three or four different shows that year, all music shows. That it was in the air, 1965. There was one show, like a Peter, Paul, and Mary show, that I was up for. I auditioned. It actually went to pilot. It was called The Happeners. It did not sell.
Ooh, good name, though.
Yeah, good name. And another one, like, I remember it was kind of a Beach Boy group, surfing band. I don't remember the name, but I was up to that. And there was another one that was a big folk band, like a New Christy Minstrel, a Mighty Wind, you know, that kind of big family. Well, it was a big family of, you know, one of those big 20-piece folk bands. I was up for that. That didn't go to pilot either. But there was then this show called The Monkees. And I remember it being distinctive. I remember, first of all, the producers were very young, in their early 30s, and unheard of for television producers at the time. It was irreverent a little bit. It was about that hippie generation. And the unique thing about it was, of course, at that time, the only time you ever saw long-haired kids with bell-bottoms and tie-dyed shirts, they were usually being arrested. So, and it was a counterpoint to that, a counterpoint in saying, look, I mean, kids are not always, you know, doing crimes against nature. They just want to sing and are too busy to put anybody down, which is the long answer.
Now, if you hadn't passed the audition, and I'm talking to Mickey Dolenz, who did pass the audition and became a monkey and has been for many, many years, among many, many other things. But Mickey, if you hadn't passed the audition, what do you think you would have done with your life? What do you think you would have become?
Well, I can tell you, at the time of the audition, I was enrolled in a college studying to be an architect. And I had already a year, a couple of semesters under my belt, and I was doing little TV things, kind of as summer jobs to, you know, make a little money. But I was going to be an architect.
Huh.
And the Monkee audition, well, these auditions came along. I wasn't a fool. I knew the power of a television series. So I had an agent, and I was going out in auditions. But when I got the pilot, I did my auditions. My audition piece, besides the acting and stuff, was Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry. I played guitar at the time. So when I got the pilot, I took a few days off, 10 days or something, to shoot the pilot, but I didn't even quit school. I went back to college after the pilot, and then a few months later, when it sold at the overnights in New York mm-hmm. at the time, then I did quit school. But I was going to be an architect, and that is, my plan was to be an architect, and if I couldn't make it as an architect, I would fall back on showbiz.
See, that's what I would have expected, because looking over the resume of what you did do with your life, you've had so many different jobs in show business beyond the Monkees TV show or the Monkees as a functioning band. You've directed television. You've been a disc jockey. I've been doing this for over 40 years. You were a disc jockey and you started out in New York City, for crying out loud. You lucky dog.
I know. That was incredible. I had done a bit of guest jockeying, over the years. I really loved it. I was a big fan. I loved the idea. I used to, do guest jockeying and do my, hey, and the next one is, and that was, and here we are, it's Mickey Dolan's KWWT in Boston. I loved it. When I was a little kid at, like, around Circus for a time or a little after, I used to be in electronics and I would build Heath kits, which you probably are aware of. And I built an FM little radio transmitter and I would transmit from my garage to my mother's radio in the kitchen. Hi, it's the weather in the driveway. And so when I got offered that gig, I was thrilled. And I got to tell you, though, when I started doing it and doing it for real, I always had a respect for the industry, but it gave me an incredibly newfound respect. It was probably the toughest job I ever had in my life.
Really?
It's really tough. It's, first of all, I have the morning shift.
Yeah.
And so I'm up at 3 or 4 mm-hmm. getting my show together.
I know the drill.
And I'm not an early riser. So that was an issue. But it was just very, very tough, because I realized shortly into it that whereas as an actor, you have all 5 senses, well, not taste maybe, but you have all your senses to work with. Obviously, the visual and the sound and your voice and your gestures and you have all that. But as you know, on the radio, you got one. It's your voice.
And that's my voice.
And all the emotions, all the information, everything has to be transmitted, communicated with that one sense.
I'm taking notes here, Mickey, because, I thought I was just pushing buttons and talking. It was a pretty easy gig, but you're making it sound like I should get a Nobel Prize or something. So thank you for...
Well, get a raise at least.
Thank you for all the props there. So I asked you what would happen to you if you hadn't passed the audition, and one of the reasons I asked is because I met this guy once who auditioned for the Monkees, and he did not pass. And this was brought up in an interview with him. His name is Stephen Stills. I wasn't doing the interview. The guy doing the interview started the interview by saying, hey, tell me about not getting in the Monkees. And it went downhill from there.
I don't know. I wasn't privy. I didn't know Stephen at the time. I mean, he was unknown like I was, mm-hmm. except for Circus Boy. But I don't really know anything. There have been rumors about other people auditioning But I don't know, because I was only 20 years old myself and just went to the auditions and did my thing. And then one day I was introduced to Peter, Mike, and Davey, and literally one day at a wardrobe fitting. And, they said, okay, you 4 guys are the Monkees. And I'm like, oh, hi, my name's Mickey. And, hi, I'm Mike. I remember Davey from the auditions, the screen tests, because I think we kind of hit it off a little bit because he had also been in television and in theater. And so we had a little bit in common with having as child stars.
Sure, sure. Like you, he seems to project a lot of enthusiasm and has no time for putting anybody down. So that was good. One thing that's interesting about Davey is that he knew how to play drums. You knew how to sing and play guitar. So naturally, you got cast as...
the drummer. Well, that's the way it goes in Hollywood and in TV and in movies, And when they said, you're going to be the drummer, I said, I play guitar. And they said, we have enough guitar players. So you're going to be the drummer. And I said, great, where do I start? My first instrument was classical guitar, Spanish guitar, like Segovia, and then morphed into folk music because I would go to parties in high school, and I'd play, you know, Malaguena or something with my guitar, and I would get invited to parties because I played guitar. And I'd play Malaguena, and then the girls would say, "Do you know any Kingston Trio?" And I said, "I'll be right back." So, and then I learned Tom Dooley and started playing folk music and singing and stuff. And then that morphed into to rock and roll. And like I said, my audition piece was Johnny B. Goode.
And you were in the band at that point. So here's where it gets confusing, though, because you're cast as the drummer, and then you guys make a record. It's Last Train to Clarksville. It immediately goes number one. So the show about the struggling band is about a band that actually has a number one record. And who's singing lead vocals on that? Was that the lead singer from the DP show? No, it was you. You sang on all the best songs.
Well, I had most of them. Yeah, Davey sang a couple of great ones, too. But, yeah, I just, I don't know. And be honest, I wasn't privy to that stuff. We weren't. We had no control, as you've probably heard, about what was recorded, who wrote it, who released it. What, very little or no control, essentially.
Well, you sounded awesome on it. I just want to take a break here and play it.
Oh, yeah, they were great songs. I mean,
I went out and bought the record right away. I knew it was a TV show. I knew the whole thing was fictional, but the songs were so good, I was like, I got to have this record. I went right out and bought it. So let's check it out. Last Train to Clarksville. It is the Monkees. Mickey Dolenz is my guest, and this is 101.7 WCVT Classic Hits Vermont. WCVT Classic Hits Vermont with the Monkees and a former number one hit, Last Train to Clarksville, sung by the band's drummer, Mickey Dolenz, who's my guest on the telephone this morning as we get set for the Monkees Farewell Tour stop at the Flynn tomorrow night. So tell me about the show. What can people expect of the Flynn? Are they going to get the stories of the Monkees in addition to the music?
Oh, yeah. We always have to some degree, more sometimes more than less. But Nez and I, we have settled into telling quite a few interesting stories, like I did a solo album recently called Dolenz Sings Nesmith, and I do a song called Different Drum, which of course you know, that was a song. And I tell the story that that Nez told me that he went in the early days of the Monkees. He'd written that even before the Monkees. And he tried to sell it to the producers, and they said, no, it's not a Monkee tune. And he said, but wait a minute, I am one of the Monkees. And they said, well, yeah, but thank you, but no thank you. Don't call us, we'll call you. And so he gave it to this young girl, unknown singer, kicking around at the time in Los Angeles, Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies. And, of course, the rest is history. But we tell that and some other stories about what went on. But also, we always, and I have always done always the big hits, always, and in their entirety, no medleys, always the big hits, like you mentioned, Clarksville. And just as people remember it, because I've always felt that was very, very important, that the people are coming to hear those songs, the big ones. I'm a Believer, Clarksville, Daydream Believer, Pleasant Valley Sunday, Stepping Stone. I've learned over the years that once they know, and now our fans do, that once they know they're going to get those hits, then they can kind of relax. And you can kind of do then whatever you want, almost. I mean, I've done non-Monkee tunes. In my solo show, for instance, I tell the story of Johnny B. Goode as my audition piece, and I do that. I tell the story of Jimi Hendrix opening for us, and I do a kind of a little truncated version of like Foxy Lady or something. When the kids used to be going in the middle of Foxy Lady, we want Davy! We want Davy! Yeah, so we do tell some stories, but we also do some deep cuts. We do stuff off of Good Times. We do the Ben Gibbard tune, Me and Magdalena. And we give credit always to the songwriters. Because, you know, as you know, the songwriters in the early days, incredible songwriters, Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Neil Sedaka, Neil Diamond.
That's the one I was going to mention. You guys gave a huge leg up to Neil Diamond in his career when he managed to score a hit with you guys. And later on, he did it himself and did about a billion other hits, too. But he had no hits or anything before he wrote that one for you guys.
He's an incredible writer. And I finally met him years later, and he, you know, was wonderful. I mean, and David Gates and Harry Nilsson had his first hit with us.
What an experience to be part of that swirling milieu of the mid-60s in L.A. and at the top of the heap, just boom, overnight like that. That has to have been incredible. Thank you so much for making so much time for me. Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees, the Monkees Farewell Tour with Mike Nesmith and Mickey Dolenz, the surviving members.
Going on in the Flynn tomorrow night, and we're going out with another former number one hit, sung by the drummer for the band, Mickey Dolenz, and written by Neil Diamond. Here's I'm a Believer from 101.7 WCVT Classic Hits Vermont.
Was only true in fairy tales, meant for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me, that's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face, now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. I thought love was...
The Monkees tomorrow night at the Flynn. Thanks to Zeb Norris of Classic Hits Vermont, WCVT 101.7, for sharing that interview with Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll be back to share some baseball stories with author Thomas Christopher Green. You can too. And today at 1 o'clock, it's Travels with Charlie, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Senior Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. World Series starts tomorrow night, and for most people in this area, they'll watch without much of a stake in the game. For Red Sox fans, it was a better-than-expected season and a playoff run that made things exciting, while the Pats and Celtics have kind of stumbled out of the gate. Red Sox fans can take a wee bit of solace from the fact that the Yankees have been eliminated and more from the fact that it came at the hands of the Red Sox. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on the season or maybe share a memorable trip to a ballpark, any ballpark. On social media last week, I read a great story by author Thomas Christopher Green, and I invited him to share it with us this morning and to talk baseball. Thomas is the author of 6 novels, including Mirror Lake, The Headmaster's Wife, and most recently, The Perfect Liar. He's also the founder and president emeritus of the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Thomas, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me. It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Thomas about one of his books or if you want to share a great baseball story, our numbers are 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Thomas, I think you came by your love of the Red Sox pretty naturally. So tell us about, you know, when you became a Sox fan.
Well, I didn't really become a Sox fan. I was born one.
There we go.
That's the way it is where I grew up in Massachusetts, you know, Irish Catholic family, seven kids, and baseball was, you know, just another version of a religion for us. And the Red Sox, in Fenway Park in particular, was our cathedral.
Do you remember your first trip to Fenway?
I do. It was 1978, which I would have been 10 years old. And I remember the feeling of walking through the grandstands there and seeing the field for the first time and being so stunned by it, by just the sheer greenness of the lawn, which I was entirely unprepared for. I thought it was actually the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that first game was a remarkable game. The pitching matchup, I still remember, it was two Hall of Famers. It was Red Sox against the Texas Rangers. Gaylord Perry was pitching for the Rangers. And Ferguson Jenkins was pitching for the Red Sox. Oh. And the whole way down the car, my dad was telling me about Gaylord Perry and his famous spitball. you know, he was famous for being a cheater and being really good at it. And this fascinated me tremendously. And my dad said, watch, the umpire's going to come out. They'll check his glove. They'll do other things. No one ever catches him. And, you know, I've had a lifelong love of con men and writing about them in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaylord Perry was the first one I ever saw in person, I think. And what was amazing to me about seeing him, actually, is that, you know, people age differently then, and he looked like somebody's grandfather.
He did. Yeah. Well, it's funny because my first game at Fenway wasn't until the 80s, but it was the Rangers as well. I was living down in Miami, and I met this woman. She was a sales rep for a magazine up in Mass, and invited me to come up and you know, spend the weekend and get together, see, you know, how we'd get along. And I flew in to Logan, and we went right off to Fenway, and my first game against the Rangers as well. Sat right by Pesky Paul. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun, and it was, you know, I was already a Sox fan for about 20 years growing up in Pennsylvania, but getting to Fenway that first time was just amazing. How about playing baseball? What was it like in your neighborhood? Was it all organized like Little League, or was there a lot of sandlot games going on?
It was both. We would play games in the backyard, but also we had a pretty vibrant Little League culture. You know, I'll tell you another brief sort of funny baseball story. Was
yeah.
When I was president of college, we have at graduation, there's always a graduating student, and these are graduate students who gives a commencement address in addition to me. And one year, this guy got up there, and he's about my age, and he gave this great graduation speech, and I went up and I thanked him after, and he looked at me and he said, you know, you used to play for Du Bois Auto Body, which was my little league team. And I said, are you kidding me? And he's like, yeah, I would played for Marine Oil. He said, he used to pitch. And I said, I did. And then suddenly, you know, through the veneer of age and time passing, I recognized him. And I said, were you really tall? And he said, yeah, I was the same height then that I am now. I'm 6 feet tall, but I was 6 feet tall as a 12-year-old. And I was like, oh, and I had this memory of him hitting a home run off me. And I just thought of all of the things in the world that would have to conspire over a period of time to find us both on the same stage in Montpelier, Vermont, these many years later is pretty remarkable.
That is incredible. Gosh, I love it. You know, he had a big strike zone. You could have moved the ball around, but when you serve him up a meatball and he took you deep.
I was just trying to get it over the plate.
I mean, that was,
I know. You know, I think I pitched a no-hitter once and walked 13, you know. It was that kind of thing. I could bring it a little bit, but I certainly couldn't control it.
Now, we played things like stick ball. We played fist ball. We played wiffle ball in addition to baseball in our neighborhood. Any of those that you guys grew up with?
Oh, yeah. Yes, all of them. You know, we used to play stick ball against a wall with a ball and a broomstick.
Yep.
And that was a really fun game. We played pickle all the time, where you had two bases and people would run.
Yeah.
And then we actually played this game called parking lot ball that we made up where, because there was a giant, I grew up next to an all-girls Catholic high school, and there was a giant parking lot that was often empty on weekends. And we would play this thing called parking lot ball where we would hit a tennis ball with a tennis racket.
Oh.
And you could really crank it, so it was super fun. You'd hit it towards the building, and if you put it on the roof, it was a home run. So that was also a really fun game.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. We would bounce the ball off the wall and play three flies. We would play all kinds of things, home run derby. As we talk, the more I can think of games that, we made up. Well, you mentioned you were a pitcher in Little League there for Du Bois Auto. Did you have any kind of illustrious baseball career, moving forward?
No, I had actually a pretty good basketball career, but I was kind of terrified of the ball, honestly. I think I was so uncomfortable as a hitter that I probably my career essentially ended after Little League. And but I did play basketball into high school and into college. But baseball was always my first love.
Yeah, and there was no DH then that they could as a pitcher have you sit.
There was no DH, but till recently, when I'd get together with my college buddies, we get together once a year in the Adirondacks where a friend of mine has an old house on top of a mountain. And I think we finally aged out of it, but we would play wiffle ball for 5 or 6 hours on Saturday, competitively with all kinds of ground rules and fast pitch. And, it's just, there's something just so iconic about the game and its translation to different areas like we just talked about.
Yeah. Well, you did post this story on social media about you and your daughter, the first game that took you. You took her to Fenway. So tell us about that.
Well, we were actually talking the other day, and I was telling her how I was tired because these Red Sox games have been going so late, and she's now a sardonic teenager. She's 15, and she said, "Baseball, is that still a thing?" And I said, "Of course it's still a thing." And it just jogged my memory of the one time I took her to a game, which was would have been 2012. She was 6 years old. It was first week of April, and I splurged for great seats. It was because in early season they're easier to get, And it was Sox were playing the Oakland A's. John Lester was pitching for the Red Sox, and we had seats in the third row on the visitors on deck circle.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a crazy view. And the first several innings, I was just terrified because they didn't put the netting up then. And I had the 6-year-old girl
right.
I'm trying to protect, and I'm worried about line drives hitting us. I thought she would be so into like the field and the same experience I had, but she didn't have the same frame of reference. So she was into the fact that, they'd bring you ice cream to where you sat. And also, she was obsessed with wanting a baseball. It's like, can we better get a ball, can we catch a foul ball? And I'm explaining to her that just doesn't happen, I was sort of doing the math in my head, and I don't know if there's 40 foul balls that are hitting the game or something like that. But in a stadium that holds 36,000 people, the chances of us getting one are probably pretty slim.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the game went on, you know, it was about the seventh inning, Lester was still pitching, and one of the Oakland A's hitters hit a foul ball way behind us. Looked like it was leaving the park, sideways, going out the back side of the park.
Right.
And for some reason, I stood up in my chair, and I started to walk up the steps. And I was watching the ball. And then I kept walking a little faster, and I suddenly realized in this moment of terror, like Little League terror, I could see the scenes, like this thing was coming right at me. And all around me, I heard people rushing me, you know, like zombies,
right,
all thinking the same thing. I want the ball. And I just never took my eye off it. And I held up my right hand, and I caught it clean.
Wow.
And the crowd went bananas around me. and I went down, and I brought it to my daughter, and I handed it to her. And they put us up on the Jumbotron with the words that said, "Nice job, Dad." And, you know, we broke the date on the ball in the game, and she still has it somewhere in her messy room.
Well done. And this is the guy who was afraid of the ball playing in grade school. So really,
I tell you, Rick, I couldn't type for 3 days. My hand was so bad.
Yeah. I know. I caught a home run ball once off the bat of Carlos Baerga. He was with the Mets. It was down in Marlins, Joe Robbie Stadium. But being, you know, a Marlins fan, I had to throw it back, my only home run ball. And there was a little kerfuffle, wasn't there, in the area where you were sitting?
Yeah. Even the better part of that story was in the eighth inning, the row in front of us had been empty the whole game. In the eighth inning, all these sort of bros showed up. I'm calling them bros, but they were kind of young Masters of the Universe types, you know, frat boys turned Wall Street. You know, they had their ties askew, and had been out drinking, I think, all day before the game, and had the kind of privilege where you can buy really expensive seats and show up for one inning. and they came in, and they were just obnoxious. They were immediately loud. They were shouting vulgarities. But 5 feet away from them, maybe 10 feet away from them, was Josh Donaldson, the Oakland A's third baseman. And he was in the on-deck circle taking his cuts while the other guy was hitting. And they just started screaming F-bombs at him. You know, "Donaldson, sit down. Donaldson, we can't see. Donaldson, get down in front." All this kind of stuff. And he finally turned around, and he started to walk toward them. And Josh Donaldson in person is enormous.
Yeah.
I mean, he had biceps bigger than my thighs. He was just like all rippling muscle. And he had the bat in his hand up near his head. And I thought, he's going to come in the stands and destroy these guys. But instead, he walked right to the edge of the fence. So he's right next to them. And he says to them, "Gentlemen, I heard what you're saying. My manager requires us, actually, when we're in the on-deck circle, to take swings, to time ourselves to the pitcher that's there. So I'm just trying to do my job here. I hope you can understand." He said in a very soft voice. And then he raised his voice just slightly. He said, "And also, I just want to say to you that, you know, I don't think you would appreciate it if I showed up where you work and started yelling F-bombs at you when we didn't know each other. Have a little respect. There's children here." And then he turned around and walked away, and they were quiet the rest of the game. I thought it was one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen in my life.
Ah, kudos to Josh Donaldson. Gosh, I love that. Just really quickly, does your daughter remember the occasion as vividly as you do?
I think no. I mean, I think she remembers. I think no. I think it's gotten lost the miasma of time in her life.
But
that's okay. You know, I mean, it's one of those shared memories that we'll always have.
Yeah, Thomas. Any other games at Fenway or elsewhere that really stand out that you remember well?
You know, not necessarily a game, but I was in Boston in the winter, probably 5 or 6 years ago, raising money for Vermont College of Fine Arts. And I was going to a small kind of gathering at an apartment that was near Kenmore Square. And when the cab dropped me off to near the house, they dropped me off right on the backside of Fenway. And this was like in February. And for some reason, this stretch of street was entirely abandoned. It was just me. And Fenway was open. There was, you know, the gates were open. The lights were on the field. And I thought, all right, I probably shouldn't go in there. it's probably Matt Damon and Ben Affleck taking batting practice or something with Theo Epstein. I don't know what's going on, but I, you know, so, but I did. I couldn't help it. I just walked in there and I walked up the stairs and I just wanted to see the field at night in winter. There was no snow. The field looked green. The lights were on. And I was like, I probably shouldn't be in here. So then I got out. But it was really kind of remarkable to see the place totally empty.
Oh, my gosh. It's a fan's dream. You know, you get the stadium to yourself. Wow. How often do you get down for games?
Oh, you know, not as much anymore, I have to say. I mean, I used to go, you know, I used to try to go once a year or every other year. But I haven't in a few years. And honestly, you know, this season has actually brought me back a little bit to baseball. I think I've always been a Red Sox fan, but I lost a little bit of my passion, I think, over the last couple of years. And last year, for instance, I definitely couldn't watch baseball during COVID. And I think part of that is because the great thing about sports, right, is that they're sort of palliative that help us forget the realities of other parts of life. And during COVID, baseball was actually a kind of dramatic reminder with the empty stands and everything of kind of collective trauma we were all going through. And then this year, I started watching in spring training, and I really felt there was something special about this team. Mm-hmm. And I did from the beginning, and I've got a friend of mine I walk with all the time, and he's not a Red Sox fan, but he's a Mets fan and diehard baseball fan. And after the Red Sox lost the first three games this year to the Orioles, I bet him that they would make the playoffs. And he said to me, "You are such a homer. I mean, there's no way this team's going anywhere." But I just felt something about kind of both, you know, Alex Cora's leadership, but also the kind of joy and joie de vivre these guys played with every mm-hmm. day. So this season felt like a real victory for me, even though they lost at the end. I don't feel the same sense of heartbreak because I felt like these guys left everything on the field they could, and they were a really fun team to root for.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's take a call now from John, who's joining us from Waterbury. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. I don't know if the fog of time I'll get all the details correct. I think it was September of 1990. My recollection, it was a nighttime game, last game of the season, and they were going to clinch what I think would have been the American League East. And it was a good sized raucous crowd, and seventh inning, the very, very large garage door that's, I think, in the Green Monster.
Yeah.
It opened. And out on horseback came about at least a half a dozen of Boston's finest.
Oh, right.
And I think they were sending a message to the fans, don't even think about celebrating on the field when the game ends.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That was a pretty wild scene and I remember Philly doing that. Other cities had been doing that at the time, bringing in the mounted police to kind of keep fans off the field. John, thanks for that memory. Wow. I don't know if you're Thomas, the kind of guy who visits ballparks when you go elsewhere, but do you know how many other ballparks you've been to in Major League Baseball?
I have actually only been to Fenway.
No kidding. A purist. I like that.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, I've been in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. a bunch, and and in Chicago and for work, and I just never managed to squeeze in a game. And it's one of the things I regret. Maybe now that I have a little more time, that'll be one of the things I'll end up doing.
Well, let's talk about your writing. I never got to speak to you about Perfect Liar, which was a really gripping story. That's the last book you've had out, set in Burlington. So tell the listeners just a little bit about that story.
Well, The Perfect Liar is a story of a marriage, but it's a story of a marriage where it's when neither party actually knows the person they're actually married to. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got deep secrets. It's told from basically both points of view, the husband's point of view and the wife's point of view. In essence, the novel begins when they move to Burlington, Vermont, where he's become a very famous artist and is hired by UVM with a teaching job and a house and all kinds of success. He's come out of nowhere as an artist. And notes start appearing on the door of their house that say, the first one says, "I know who you are." And he immediately gets incredibly scared that someone is on to his secret, that he's not exactly who he says he is. And the story goes from there.
Yeah, it is really gripping. I enjoyed that a lot. Are you working on anything right now, Thomas?
Yeah, I'm working on a bunch of things, actually. I'm working on a collection of essays based on some of the stories I've told on Facebook, like the one you read and enjoyed, and trying to compile those together, sort of true stories and anecdotes from my life. And I'm also in the process of sort of working through the kind of outline, which I normally don't do, but I'm doing a different process this time of a new novel with my literary agents, and we're in conversations about the shape of that, and I think we're really excited about where that's heading. So got a lot of projects underway, and you know, it's actually, you know, this has been a good time to write in a way, because, you know, what else are we going to do the last year and a half? So I've actually produced quite a bit of work, and hopefully excited to share some with the world pretty soon.
And you have a brother who's president at Colby College, the White Mules. How did two members of the same family wind up as college presidents?
Actually, three. My dad was a college president.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no, it's kind of a crazy story. I mean, and there's, you know, we have seven kids, and, you know, my dad grew up in poverty in Haverhill, Massachusetts. He's the only one in his family to graduate even high school. And his mother was a cook at Bradford College in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And when my dad was about 12 years old, he saw the president of the college come in to the cafeteria and saw the way people responded to him. He said, "You know what? I'm going to be president of college someday." And sure enough, he did. I mean, he got his PhD at night from Boston University while, you know, teaching high school and working in a liquor store. He ended up as first a professor, and then he became president of St. Thomas University in Miami, Florida.
Where I went, where I got my master's.
Yeah, so he was president there in the late 80s and the 90s. And then, you know, my brother, he had followed that pathway the whole way. He went to, you know, got his PhD from Harvard in education, and he's worked in higher ed his whole life, and he's a remarkable college president who's really transforming Colby College in Maine. And for me, it was more accidental. I mean, I drifted into academia coming out of college when I moved to Montpelier, so I was looking for a job, and I ended up at Norwich and kept getting promoted there and ended up on the leadership team at Norwich when I was in my 20s. And then when Vermont College was going to close in Montpelier in 2006, when they were owned by Union University, I built a nonprofit and created Vermont College of Fine Arts, and everybody pretty much made me stay as president, so I didn't really have a choice.
Wow, that is really a fantastic story, and I just love hearing it. Thomas Christopher Green, founder and president emeritus of the Vermont College of Fine Arts in Montpelier, author of six books, including the most recent, The Perfect Liar. You will really enjoy it, folks. Thomas, it was great having you on this morning. Thanks so much for sharing these memories.
My pleasure, Rick. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update, then we'll be back to check out a mansion and mausoleum in Cuttingsville that just might be haunted, very haunted. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Years ago, someone told me about this kind of creepy, kind of wonderful mausoleum that I needed to check out in Cuttingsville. Off I went, and it was great, a great Vermont find to add to my list of interesting places in the state. And across the street was the family's mansion, but alas, it wasn't open. Then last week, the Laurel Glen Cemetery Association announced that it was getting ready to hold an historic marker presentation in a couple of weeks, and that the building will be open for tours. Road trip. Anyone with me? Of course, this is a siren's call for me, a perfect excuse to reach out and invite someone on the show so we can learn about another slice of Vermont history. So joining me now to educate us on the Bowman family mansion and the mausoleum in Cuttingsville is Tom Giffen, a Bowman Mansion board member. Tom, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question about the mansion or mausoleum, or if you've ever been, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. And you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's start with the man himself, Tom. Who was John Bowman?
Oh, John Porter Bowman, he was born in 1816 at Pierce's Corner, and people who are familiar with Pierce's Corner store, I mean, will know where it is. His father ran a tavern, and which was frequented by the Green Mountain Boys for that period.
Wow.
He was very young, and he learned he was apprenticed in the tanning business. He moved to Rutland, Vermont, and he learned the trade, and then he ended up going to New York and saving his money, and he opened up his own tanning operation in the south of the village of Cuttingsville. While then, he also was elected to the legislature in 1852, and he married his wife, Jeannie. And then he moved to Stony Creek, New York, and he made a very large fortune selling his leather goods to the Union Army during the Civil War.
Well, what sad events led him to build that mausoleum in Cuttingsville?
Well, his daughter, who was 4 months old at the time, passed away, and then in 1880, died in 1854. Then his wife and his 22-year-old daughter died of cholera, they believe, or typhoid in 1880. So he was grief-stricken, and he returned to the Cuttingsville to build a mansion and mausoleum in 1880. And he never really recovered, I think, from the deaths of his wife and his two children. So he decided to make this mausoleum, which was quite impressive, as you have seen.
Yeah.
It was designed by an architect named G.B. Croft, who also did a lot of work in designing Central Park in Brooklyn. And he employed 125 sculptors and marble granite cutters, and cost about $75,000, which is over $1 million in today's money, to build this mausoleum to house the remains of his family and eventually him.
Now, he had been living in New York, so why did he decide to build it here in Vermont in Cuttingsville?
He was from that area, and this was going to be his summer home. So the house that he built was, you know, he eventually occupied it in later life, but that was just going to be his summer home that he was going to be living in. And that's where he grew up, was in the Cuttingsville area of Pierce's Corner, and he wanted to bring it back there.
Now tell us about Cuttingsville, because I'm not sure everyone listening even knows much about the village itself.
Cuttingsville is basically part of Shrewsbury. Mm-hmm. It's heading down Route 103. And it's a very small, quaint Vermont village. It has a historical society and a country store, and it's a very Vermontish kind of place to visit. But it also was he chose that place because, again, that's where Bowman felt most comfortable, I think. And coming back to Vermont to build this, he could have stayed in Stony Brook and stayed there and built his house, but he wanted it to be in Cuttingsville.
Mm. Can you give us a tour around the mansion verbally and let people know what that is like?
Well, the mansion itself is a very large, ornate building, built in Lake style. It's he had spared no expense. The master bedroom overlooks the road that goes, and so you can see the mausoleum where his family was buried. It's a very ornate structure with all kinds of, has a grand hallway, it has floor to ceiling mirrors, it has the original wallpaper around one of the fireplaces. He had ported tiles that each tile is part of the, Shakespearean play, scene from that. Hmm. There was a music room, fireplaces, a parlor, dining room. I mean, it was amazing, amazing. It is an amazing, amazing building.
And after John Bowman passed away, how was it cared for?
There was money left from the estate from John Bowman, $50,000 to maintain it the way he would want he it was. And that would include, I mean, there was a greenhouse on the site that would provide flowers. There was a carriage house. There's another building, and to maintain servants and the and to keep it up. Unfortunately, you know, in the 50s, that money was did not go far. They had to have an auction to sell off some of the furniture and to keep it maintained. So now there is rental property goes to the site, and that's what's maintaining it.
So who owns the property today?
The association is the one who is responsible for maintaining it. So we're a nonprofit, and it's owned by the association.
Mm, gotcha.
Actually, there's a law that says it's owned by the association.
Now,
Bowman, when he drew all this stuff up, he made sure that it was in the Vermont statutes, and that there has to be a report made every year to say what's going on.
Oh, wow. Boy, he really planned ahead. Take us back across the street to the mausoleum, because there's some unique statuary that graces the mausoleum.
Well, the mausoleum, again, was designed by a New York architect, I said, G.B. Croft, and it's very elaborate. He made a point to have the grieving version of himself put on the steps. Where he right on front of the tomb, he has a wreath, a mourning, and a large tea to show him. And if you ever go to the mausoleum, it is quite an impressive. It's one of the more unique types of funerary, they call it, mm-hmm. for sculptures that there is in the state of Vermont. It's made out of granite and marble, huge pieces of granite, stone wall. It's an amazing piece of art of architecture, including with his life-size statue of Bowman with what he told him.
And right near the road, right across the street from the mansion, like you said, so he could gaze out at it. But as you're driving by, it's one of those things that's so arresting, and you spot it and you have to stop.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those things that, I mean, it's on the people. We get calls all the time where people want to know more about it, where it is, and it is certainly a very unique part of Vermont history as far as everything. I mean, if he was in the legislature, he made millions of dollars in today's money. He spared no expenses. The artist, when you go into the mausoleum, the granite, everything that's there, it was very, very, very expensive, and but he had no qualms while spending the money that he had for the mausoleum and for Laurel Glenn House.
Yeah. Now, I understand that the house, Laurel Glenn House, at one time had a bookstore inside it.
It was rented out before my time on the board, but it was rented out to called the Haunted Mansion Bookstore.
Of course.
It was there for several years.
All right. Tom, has anyone lived in the mansion since it has been, you know, vacant after the Bowman family passed away?
To my knowledge, nobody else has lived in the mansion. It has been rented out a couple times, but after Bowman died in 1891, there was nobody living in the mansion.
Wow. And can you tell us about Laurel Glen Cemetery? I mean, I know the mausoleum is there, but what else can you tell us about the cemetery itself?
Well, the cemetery, when Bowman decided to build his mansion in the mausoleum in Cuttingsville, he also took over the Laurel Glen Cemetery. And he made that to what we would call a garden cemetery. And it had the cast iron large flower holders. He had a greenhouse on the site just to provide flowers for the area. And he restored it all and put a beautiful stone wall around it. And it became the Laurel Glen Cemetery that he took over and became part of the mansion, and then hence the Laurel Glen Association.
And is the greenhouse still there and still producing flowers?
No, the greenhouse is still there, but it's not producing flowers anymore. Mm. But we have high hopes that a lot of these different buildings that have been not being used and so long with to be used again. And that's one of the reasons we're having the historical marker presentation on November 6th at 11 to call more attention to the building and to have more people being come involved with the restoration and just the knowledge of what this treasure that we have in, you know, southern Vermont.
Yeah, so that's happening on November the 6th. Did you say at 11?
11 o'clock. We will have speakers, and then after the unveiling of the historical marker, we'll open up the building. And we also, the Shrewsbury Historical Society, which is right across the street, will also be open. They have it's worth a trip to see what they have.
Oh, outstanding. Is this the only time the mansion will be open?
We had it opened a couple weeks ago, and we had it where there was a tapped table group down there for maple syrup. It was a big gathering down in Cuttingsville, and we had it open at a large group of people that were coming in and were very interested in the building, because it has, again, it's original wallpaper. It has basically probably the best preserved building of its era with all the original things, the carpets and everything that are still there. Mm. So it is quite interesting.
And how long will the mansion be open that day on November 6th?
Well, we're volunteers, and we probably will keep it open as long as people are showing up.
Oh, that's outstanding. Now, I have to ask, Tom, is the Bowman Mansion haunted?
Well, okay, Bowman died in 1891 and joined his family in the mausoleum. He believed in reincarnation. He left money in the will, and which dried up in 1953. We get calls periodically and things about hauntings and strange things happening around the mansion at night. The kind of fun ones have been reported, and one of my favorites is a 8-year-old girl was walking up the master staircase, and on the wall by the master staircase is a large portrait of John Bowman and his wife Jenny, and the little girl decided to stick out her tongue at the portrait of Mrs. Bowman, and in front of witnesses, allegedly, or whatever, the portrait flew off the wall and almost hit the child in front of many, many witnesses. So I like that one.
Wow.
People can say about flickering lights, footsteps. A recurring one that they've been hearing is about an infant crying in the building, which is interesting because there never was an infant that lived in the building, but that's been reported on numerous occasions. There's been spirit sightings reported in every room and flickering lights. What I just checked out yesterday, because I was in the mansion yesterday, was at the top of the grand staircase, there's supposed to have been a stain which could have been blood or whatever, and that people would stand there back in the day and they would say they'd have feelings of dread. Now, I went up there yesterday, I took the carpet, and I could see no stain at the top of that of the staircase. So I think that particular one might not be true. But
but Tom, did you have feelings of dread?
I have feelings of dread, but I will say I was walking down the down by the servants' quarters one day, and I did sit. We were talking with a couple of other members, we were talking about what would we think Bowman would be saying about what we were doing, and as soon as I said that, there was an old radio on the counter that. Either was on or just turned on real quickly. So I don't know.
Wow.
That's my biggest experience with the feelings of dread, I guess.
Oh, I like that one. And I think, I don't know if you mentioned this, but I know, left in the will for the trust to maintain the house, didn't dinner have to be at least, not served, but a place setting set out every night?
Well, he was an adamant believer in reincarnation,
mm-hmm.
and he believed that eventually that he would be reunited, I'm assuming, in the house with his family. When I was a little kid, I remember hearing the rumors that they would have hot meals and things. I did have servants. I think they did change the linen, and I think they did keep the place up had mold, and just in case he did show up one day at the door. But I do not believe that there were hot meals being prepared, but I do think they did change linen and took care of the house just in case he did show up. But he probably wanted to get his money back. I don't know.
All right. And so you've got this historical marker that's being unveiled on November 6th. Why did you decide to have the marker put in place there?
Well, the mausoleum and the mansion are on the historical registered state of Vermont. And we believe that the marker would designate this as a site that people would want to see and also give it the recognition it deserves. And our goal is, to call much more attention to the building than it's had in the last 40, 50 years. And we're planning to have the historical preservation people helping us and to do some restoration work there. And our first step was have a marker there to designate why this is important. And it's a two-sided marker. One side has about the Bowman Mansion, and the other side has about the mausoleum.
Oh, wonderful. Any other interesting history in Cuttingsville or Shrewsbury to tell us about?
Well, it's always interesting things in all around, but this particular thing, it's mostly the fascination of a kid that was 15 years old that learned this business and he wasn't going to school, and he ended up making probably today, I have no idea how many millions of dollars he made selling his leatherwares for the Civil War. I mean, it's kind of a neat story.
Yeah.
But, in Cuttingsville, also in Shrewsbury, you have the Pierce's Corner Store up there, which is very famous, and people come for that. It's a nice part of Vermont, and it's a unique part of Vermont.
Do you ever tire of seeing that mausoleum? Because it's unique. There's nothing quite like it.
Never. I've been there many times. It's something to. It certainly is breathtaking and does give you pause for thought. And again, the cemetery itself was designed for reflection. And designed with all the, I've seen the old pictures back from the turn of the century were full of flowers and it was just amazing sight. It was a place that people would bring their family, have your lunch in. That's what it was designed for. And Bowman thought enough of the mausoleum, again, to have the master bedroom with the big window looking directly across the road into the mausoleum. Mm. And the mausoleum was built with the high tech of the time. To have that many laborers coming down. I mean, 125 sculptures alone to build that is amazing piece of Vermont history, especially for the stone industry.
Yeah. If you've never seen it, a great day to get there is November 6th, starting at 11 o'clock, the unveiling of the historical marker, and then the mansion will be open for tours. Tom Giffen is a board member of the Bowman Mansion, and to learn more, you can go to ShrewsburyHistoricalSociety.com. Tom, I want to thank you for sharing this great bit of Vermont history with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to share. We also have a Facebook site with a lot of pictures of the building. If you'd like to see that before they come down to visit us on Saturday.
Oh, excellent. All right. Thanks, Tom. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Bill Sayers up next with Common Sense Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Flyin' Ryan Foundation and the Country Roads Program. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.